I say this to every guest, and it certainly probably won't apply to you, but I leave in shits and bleep out f**ks. You're welcome to go as blue as you'd like to go.
Thank you. Don't say that to a Texan sailor's daughter. So.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. I'm Austin Titchener, co-artistic director of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, now in its 20th year, number 990, Farah Kareem Cooper. Folger Shakespeare Library director Farah Kareem Cooper has written All the World's Your Stage, a new book for, as they say, children of all ages, that examines the life and times of William Shakespeare through eight of his most famous plays. Dr. Kareem Cooper is also the author of The Great White Bard, How to Love Shakespeare While Talking About Race, and we began our conversation unexpectedly by talking about the relationship between profanity and a love of language.
Well, I'm the Texan. He was the sailor. My dad was the sea captain. And so there was just profanity in my house. All my brothers joined the Navy at some point. So, yeah. So
I wonder, is there a connection between exposure to familiarity with profanity and a love of Shakespeare?
You could say that. I mean, it would be a very tenuous theory, but I would say that Shakespeare was very good at the insult, as we all know.
Yeah.
And I think he understood that when you used it, it needed to be tactical and really sharp, but also that it also revealed, and I'm not saying this about myself, but often it reveals an intellect, a kind of a sharp intellect. And so a lot of his characters who are really, really sharp are delivering these really quite hard-hitting insults. So, I mean, I guess you could, I mean, they couldn't really use profanity in the theater in that time period without getting into trouble. So right. I guess he came as close to it as he could.
But he loved innuendo.
Oh, for sure.
Goodness knows. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Not, maybe not as much as Chaucer, but yes, he did.
Yeah. I love the idea that William Shakespeare saw Geoffrey Chaucer and went, whoa, slow down.
Potentially. I mean, the only time when I used to teach 12th grade English, I had to teach a class, which is British Lit from Beowulf to Stopbard. So, I mean, ridiculously, you had to teach everything. But I remember teaching Chaucer, and the only time I ever blushed while I was teaching was trying to explain some of the jokes in The Wife of Bath's Tale. And I just remember going, oh my God, how am I going to explain this to these kids?
Well, so. And that is one of the fun aspects of your book, All the World's Your Stage, and something I'm experienced with too, is describing the plots of Shakespeare in ways that are age appropriate.
Yeah.
How did you go about that? Because your book is really, I was shocked, and genuinely surprised by how in-depth it is and how much there is going on within the pages of this thing. How did you decide what to cover, and how tricky was it describing aspects of Shakespeare's life and times and language?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. It was probably the hardest book I've ever written. And I think it's because I'm not accustomed to writing for that age group. I'm used to writing for adults. And initially, I mean, I started my career writing books for academic adults, you know, which is a whole other thing. But I think I had a great editor at DK Publishing. Her name's Sarah Foster. And she was great because she was like, look, we can advise you if you're getting a little bit too out of the realm of writing for children, we can help you to shape that. So they did. But in terms of how I chose what to talk about, we knew that there were things that, you know, kids often want to know about, or that their parents who are reading books to them want to talk about, which is Shakespeare's life. Who was William Shakespeare? Because you've got to give them a sense of why it matters, why they're reading this book anyway. Right. So who was Shakespeare? What, where did he come from? What was the time period like? What was it like for girls back then? What was it like for school children? Were the schools the same as they are now? Who were the tutors, right? Everybody always wants to hear about the tutors. But what I wanted to do was to kind of do a bit of myth busting, because in a lot of sort of Elizabethan retellings or children's stories about this time period, there's a lot of historical washing and a lot of cultural nostalgia that's kind of baked in. So I didn't want to lose the joy and the kind of excitement of this time period. But I wanted people to know that, for example, there were Black people living in England at the time. And didn't you know that? And isn't that interesting? Because I didn't know that until I was, you know, a professor, or not a professor, but right before my professorship, you know, when I'm reading this book about Black lives in the English archives, and I realize how many Black people lived in Tudor London. So this is something that you can encounter now at the age of 10 without it going into too much detail, without it feeling like someone is ramming anything politically down your throat. It's just simply telling you a fact about the time. So that's kind of what I was thinking about in terms of myth busting. And I've said this before, but I really wanted to write the book that I wish I had read when I was 10.
Yeah. So write the book you want to see. Yeah. No, I love that. And I love that in the early pages, you really simply and not delicately, but straightforwardly talk about Shakespeare as a tool of imperialism yeah. in a really great way. I mean, it was I'm such a Pollyanna sap. I look at the glass half full. Well, yes, it was terrible, but now.
Exactly. I mean, I think what I wanted to say is that, you know, obviously I hope I've communicated my deep love for Shakespeare, but part of the reason that that is there is because Shakespeare was imported, or exported, I should say, around the world. Yeah. And is a consequence, even if in some spaces a delightful consequence of empire. But people needed to understand, children needed to understand that Shakespeare now belongs to everybody. So there are people around the world who read Shakespeare and are performing Shakespeare using their own cultural storytelling practices. And that's a really exciting thing. But it was important to explain about empire. My father is half English and he went to a British school. And so he grew up learning that the sun doesn't set on the British Empire, and learning that this is a wonderful, extraordinary thing to be proud of. And it was never problematized for him as a boy. It wasn't problematized for my daughter, who is now 21, but went to school in Britain. And so I just wanted not necessarily to over-problematize it, but just to say, isn't that something?
You know. Yeah. And as you're saying that, I realize I'm sitting here in front of my bookshelf with UK bunting drinking out of a Union Jack Emma Bridgewater mug. So
that's okay. Your accent is not British. That's why it's okay.
Oh, yes. Right. Yeah. It would be gross. Right. There's ever so slight touch of Anglophilia. I've always been dazzled by the idea that even people who think they don't like Shakespeare are familiar with more Shakespeare than they think they are, because he is so pervasive in our culture. Is that a thing that you were were thinking about in writing the book for a younger audience who may be encountering Shakespeare for the first time through the pages of your book?
To a certain extent, but I think more so I was concerned about how they would encounter Shakespeare at school. So I wanted to do some myth busting and truth telling before they got there, because often that doesn't happen in the classroom. I mean, I think it's happening more and more as teachers are becoming equipped to have the conversations that the plays actually inspire you to have. But But I think I wanted to share things like the British Empire existed and that Shakespeare was a bit of a poster child, or and I also wanted to share that there were, that early modern London was not as diverse as contemporary London, but was more diverse than we've, like, you know, we've made out. And also I even have, I think I have in there, I haven't looked at it since it's been published because I'm terrified to, but I think I did talk about Queen Elizabeth sponsoring one of the earliest British slave trading expeditions. And that, you know, that's kind of something that you won't learn at school when you do your, you know, in England, your GCSEs on the tutors, if it, as it were. So I just wanted people to be able to come into their classrooms and go, oh, hang on a minute. No, that's not quite true. I remember reading this. And just to get, kind of spark a little bit of, not controversy, but contestation, you know?
Well, I was today years old when I learned that fact about Queen Elizabeth. I didn't know that at all. It's interesting. The reason I've got all this is that I'm in the Goodman Theater production of Christmas Carol.
And
it's lovely. They have a new director this year, and she's leaning into the idea that London then as now was a city of immigrants. And in 19th century London, there were many different cultures and peoples of color from around the globe. And so this production has been used colorblind casting for decades now, but it's, but now they're being conscious of it. So some of the actors are using accents that match, so they sound like what they might look like, which is wonderful. And I can, but I can just imagine certain aspects of the audience going, hey, wait, why are they talking like that? And yet there were people like this in 19th century London. London was full of folks like this.
That's right. I think there's a real responsibility to tell a story about how long the world has been a kind of global space and how it became that way. Because I think when you do have these period pieces, there's a sense in British and potentially even in American audiences of ownership of the material, because particularly white audiences. And actually, you know, we know that in Shakespeare's time, women weren't performing on the commercial stage, but people don't really protest women being in Shakespeare plays today, because women existed in that time period. And so why not just put, you know, why not have sort of equal rights and have women performing in the plays? Well, the same is true for people of color. People of color, Shakespeare would have seen them. He would have encountered them. There's even, there's great research happening right now on the relationship between the theater industry and some of these Black Africans who were living in London at the time. So, so it's not so far-fetched to see Black people on stage doing Shakespeare.
Francis Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela. And you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Podcast.
What?
Yes. Merrily and yay verily, motherfucker.
Where can you RSC the RSC? Next month, we'll perform the ultimate Christmas show abridged in Washington State at the Edmonds Center for the Arts on December 3rd, in Olympia on December 4th, and the Capitol Theater in Yakima on December 12th, as well as the Reeser Center in Beaverton, Oregon on December 10th. Sign up for our newsletter or check out the touring page at our website, ReduceShakespeare.com, or our social media pages for venue and ticket information. And now back to my conversation with Farah Kareem Cooper, the director of the Folger Shakespeare Library and the author of the children's book, All the World's Your Stage.
I saw the link to your birthday lecture, your Shakespeare birthday lecture, Shakespeare Beyond Relevance, which was so such a great lecture for a couple of reasons. One, because I just love the idea that we're trying to make Shakespeare irrelevant, which is not your point.
Yeah.
But it's also Shakespeare Beyond relevance calls into question at this time. Are people not saying Shakespeare isn't relevant, but even beyond that, the humanities are not relevant. The yeah. arts are not relevant, which seems an even bigger reason for you to have written this book. Mm. Were they related in your mind, those ideas?
Sort of. It's sort of been a trajectory for me in the work I was doing back at the Globe on Shakespeare and race and trying to create a sense of action or activism around the scholarship I was doing, in that I really didn't want to be a scholar in an ivory tower that was talking about this cultural artifact to only 15 other people. You know, I really, really wanted the work to, I saw so much beauty and usefulness in the thinking in the plays that I really wanted that to be something that was shared. But what I had been noticing is that, and this is happening everywhere, like in museum studies and elsewhere, that the idea is that you've got to make sure that these cultural icons or artifacts stay relevant. Otherwise, you know, you become obsolete as an institution. Right. But fundamentally, I still think that's kind of missing a trick, because being relevant, when you really drill down into relevance, what it really means is it's still a place for relief. It's still a place of retreat. It's not actually the thing itself. And it, yeah. and you become, it, you get into this space where you're just self-justifying. It puts you on trial. It puts your work on trial, that somehow if you're not able to prove that Shakespeare's relevant, then he'll come off the curriculum, or you lose your job as a Shakespeare theater director or professor. When fundamentally... And also, sorry, the other thing about relevance is that so often the way people argue for it, it creates a sense of universality, that Shakespeare is somehow this universal bard who speaks the language of everyone. And actually he doesn't. He was an Englishman who was writing plays and wrote really great plays in a really scrappy industry. And he understood the urgencies of a moment that is very similar to the moment that we're in right now. And actually, the thing to do is to put his work to use, is to recognize that leaning into utility means that you're not recreating a kind of cultural hierarchy, that you're not preserving something as a form of authority, because the younger generation, they already are mistrusting all forms of authority. So what makes you think by saying this is relevant, aka this is something you should do, that somehow that's going to be trusted on statement alone? So utility really says, well, what can you do with it? Why? Yeah. How is it useful to you? How can it help you think about the world that you're in right now? How can it strengthen some of those cognitive muscles that social media and the polarization of information is really starting to weaken? So, and I actually think there's a lot in the plays and the dramaturgy itself. So the way the plays are constructed, because of the specific conditions in which they were performed at that time, have built in a toolkit for learning how to think and how to see the difference between appearance versus reality. You just talked about Thisbe from Midsummer Night's Dream. Well, the interesting thing is that play has lots of meta theater in it, right? We talk about meta theater, which is when a play draws attention to itself as a play. Mm-hmm. Shakespeare does that a lot in his work. Yeah. What he's doing is he's grounding his audience in a shared reality and then asking them to stretch their muscles, their cognitive muscles, and see and build a kind of fiction on top of that reality, but then always brings you back and reminds you that you're all standing in the same wooden playhouse. And then he takes you back into that space. So then you become really comfortable with that sort of oscillation between fiction and reality, but you always have a sense that you all are sharing this reality together. And that's what we are missing now.
Yeah. That's truth telling. It's not pretending something isn't happening. It's it's acknowledging the thing that is actually happening, and that is really, really cool.
Yes.
I think one of the ways that Shakespeare remains relevant and fun is the degree to which people just keep messing with him and making his plays their own and turning them into other things. I just wrote about the Folgers production of Julius X, which I thought was, which I only read the script and didn't get to see, but just so put Shakespeare's play, Julius Caesar, to such smart use in examining the last few days of Malcolm X. It was genius, brilliant.
It was. And it actually, what is so interesting about that is it's like Julius Caesar, the last few days of Malcolm X's life, really kind of showcase this capacity for movements to turn in on themselves, right? Mm-hmm. That fundamentally, if you're going to drive yourself into a space where this is the only way to be, sooner or later, something's going to give. You know, there are factions of the Democratic Party and factions of the Republican Party. And this is something that happens. And drawing our attention to it is a really, really useful thing to do.
You were a leader at the Shakespeare's Globe in London, and now you're the leader of the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington. Is it important to you to be in institutions that emphasize the theatrical with the academic in sort of equal measure?
100%. I think that, yes, and that's partly because I was trained in an English department by fantastic scholar and other scholars, but they were not theater scholars. So I was taught to analyze Shakespeare through the lens of it being a book. And wow. And actually, it wasn't until I really started to think about its performance when I was writing my PhD and going to see some performances that I thought, oh my God, this is a whole other story. This is the story. I couldn't possibly do this in just my imagination alone. I need actors to get inside the skin of this material and to teach me something about it. And so when I went to the Globe, it became a very kind of dialogic relationship between theater and academia. And we would have conferences together, and I used to work with the actors and the directors, you know, supporting them with this, with the time period and the history and all of that. And then they used to come and talk to me at the end of the season to tell me what they were learning. And that was a really great relationship. And I think if I'm a good scholar, it's because of the work that I did with actors and because of the research that came from that body of practice.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, except for one more thing, where Dr. Kareem Cooper shares her favorite Shakespeare play, and the answer may surprise you, which I'll share with you in about 60 seconds, so stick around. Folger Shakespeare Library Director Farah Kareem Cooper's books, All the World's Your Stage and The Great White Bard, How to Love Shakespeare While Talking About Race, are available wherever books are sold. Send us your Shakespearean hot takes via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com or through a comment to us over on the socials or on our own actual website, reducedshakespeare.com, or visit my website, theshakespeareans.com. Thanks, as always, to Doctor of Funny Matthew Croak, web services by Ginger Power Limited, music by John Weber and Garage Band. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Jenga Neck. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Francis Callier and Angela V. Shelton, collectively known as Frangela. You can find their tour dates at frangela.com. And as always, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 990/2970 of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. Before we go, I just want to verify that what your favorite Shakespeare play is. I assume it's one of the smarter, more important ones, and not some bloody piece of nonsense, populist nonsense like Titus Andronicus, right?
Oh, darn it. Afraid so. I'm a Titus fan. It is my favorite play. Yes, it is one of the finest of Shakespeare's works. But it's actually, it's not because I think, oh, the poetry in it is so superior, because you can't, you know, some plays have better poetry in them than others. And it's because it is Shakespeare's earliest tragedy, and he's being so risky and so radical. You know, it's the way, it's like, you know, the way you are at the beginning of your career, where you just push hard and you think, right, this is what I want to do, and I'm just going to go for it, and I'm going to take risks. And I mean, what are the risks he took? Well, it's one of the most violent tragedies. I mean, there's a lot of violent tragedies in early Elizabethan revenge tragedy. And then again, in Jacobean tragedy, you see violence. So obviously he is going, okay, I got to have a box office hit if I want to make it in this career. But then also he's doing really kind of, he's interrogating what happens when you have this empire and then you see all of this, all of these different cultures converging in this one space that is somehow supposed to be dominated by one particular demographic. Yes. And, you know, Shakespeare brings in, you know, we're in this Roman Empire, imperial world, but then you've got Goths and then you've got the Moor. And this is a really interesting set of convergences. Like, how do these people exist or coexist? What do they do to each other? How do they think of each other within the bounds of their own culture? And then the other thing, which is really exciting to me, is Shakespeare starts to explore Black identity from the very first moment he starts writing tragedy. And this is a really fascinating decision to make. And Aaron the Moor is one of the villains in the play. But what's really interesting is that it's not straightforward villainy. There's a lot of interesting dimensions to him. Like, Ayanna Thompson, who's a Shakespeare scholar, talks about his speeches, one of his speeches is being the first ever Black Power speech, where he talks about the color of his skin, and he stands by it with pride. He's the only person in the play who seems to be good to their child, who doesn't want their child to die. You know, like, it's actually good parenting going on in this play. Oh, and it's the Black character, you know. Yeah. So that's a really fascinating. So for me, it's really just a set of conundrums, like, Shakespeare, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this right now? And also, when you put it into the theater, like the production that I saw at the Globe, directed by Lucy Bailey back in 2014, was so riveting, so exciting. It just blew my mind. It just blew my mind. And it was very violent, of course. And we had audience members who were fainting and dropping, and ambulance coming in and taking people away. It was just too much. But that in itself was interesting. So yeah, it's a really great play to spend time with.
This podcast is a production of the Reduce Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less. So much less. So much less. So much less.